Hey, it's Francis Lamb. Thanks so much for downloading this week's podcast. We hope you love the show and you love it so much that you'll want more info. Well, you can always find more info on everything you hear at splendidtable.org. Recipes, videos, more information on all of our guests and their books, and you can subscribe to our newsletter, Weeknight Kitchen. It's all about delicious things to make on weeknights. But right now, let's get to this week's show, hosted by Lynn Rosetto Casper.
This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show for people who love to eat. I'm Lynn Rosetto Casper. One of the glories of eating in a city like New York, and what I mean is a coastal city, one where immigrants have been arriving for a long, long time. Well, that glory in eating in New York comes from all the cultures people brought. From Jewish knishes to West African peanut stew, from the slickest of chic French cuisine to hole-in-the-wall ramen, those centuries of immigrants shaped the city and our country. Krishnendu Ray is the chair of the food studies program at New York University. He became fascinated by the city's intricate web of immigrant food systems, and he questioned why certain so-called ethnic foods are prized while others fall under the heading of cheap takeout. His new book, The Ethnic Restaurateur, is the result of a decade of digging for answers. Contributor Von Diaz talked with Professor Ray.
Krishnendu, it's so great to see you again.
It's great to see you too.
So you and I first met a couple of years ago in an Indian cooking class, and I remember you saying that you first learned to cook after coming to the U.S.
Yes.
How did your background inform your decision to study food?
Yeah, so in fact, it started by me not knowing anything about cooking. I'm an Indian middle-class male, so it seems we are not taught how to cook, and it seems it made no difference to us, and that was what was surprising to me. I had never thought about it. Other people had fed me mostly what Indian sociologists call kind of the servant-wife complex of cookery, that my mom did most of the cooking, and she often would have a servant come in about three times a week, help her in cooking and cleaning, etc.
Wow.
So I was fed by these women, and I had not thought about it at all.
So that was a big shift for you.
It was big, and because I came to the U.S. to study development and underdevelopment, and so I was hit by this nostalgia for Indian food, and this bigger realization that, wow, I have been fed all my life and I have not paid attention to it. Then I ran into a few books, rare books at that point of time. And I said, wow, you can think seriously about food. So I went to my advisor and I said, I think I'm going to change my dissertation.
And what was his response?
He says, don't do it. No one is going to give you a job.
But that's clearly not the case. What made you want to dig deeper specifically into the role of immigrant food workers in New York?
Yeah, it starts by me trying to kind of see what I was feeling about this nostalgia through food, how representative it is, or how exceptional it was. So I started working on reading up other immigrant experiences, and then I did a survey of immigrants, in this case about 126 households, and asked them about food and cooking and culture. One of the things I wanted to look at was, I knew from everyday experience that most of the cooks and most of the staff in the kitchen were immigrants. My first question to myself was, A, was that true throughout New York history? And can I find data on that? So I looked at the census data, and that data set goes back to 1850. Unfortunately, the census was not counting cooks, because cooks were counted under servants. Not until 1910 did cook come to be, you have a category called cooks except private. So I couldn't find the number of cooks. I could find, for instance, bakers, butchers, saloon keepers. And in fact, most bakers and butchers in most of New York history from 1850 onwards were foreign-born, German and Irish. I had no clue about it. So that was fascinating. As you kind of dig deeper into this material, surprising things emerged. For instance, I didn't realize that Americans had such a kind of a negative attitude towards German food, because for an outsider, to me, it looked like very similar to what I considered American food. Meat and potatoes, what we think. And
sure.
Think about lager, beer, think about dairy. Okay, it's very Germanic, Northern European, understandably, because the largest number of immigrants to the United States historically and for the longest longest time have come from Northern Europe, from United Kingdom, from Ireland, from Germany, etc. So what is fascinating for me was this very dynamic nature of American eating and our valuation of it. So we seem to have something that's peculiarly constant, which is we have immigrants coming in from these very different places. We don't respect their food very much for the first generation or the second generation when they are poor, they're working class folks.
Okay.
But as they start climbing up, okay, in fact, we change our judgments about how good their food is.
And can you give me an example of that?
Italian. Looking at today's kind of food scene, Italian food is the height of its popularity in the U.S. and its prestige. We have had, at least since the 1980s, expensive Italian restaurants. But if you look back at the historical material, say 1880s into 1920s, into 1930s, people, nutritionists, kind of social workers are full of disdain about Italian food and olive oil and how spicy their food is and how garlicky their food is. And their complaint is that that makes Italians susceptible to their thirst for alcohol. And remember, this is kind of happening at the same time when the anti-alcohol campaign is kind of heating up. And so if you just look at that previous example I gave, German food was considered inferior. The culture is considered inferior. In fact, Ben Franklin was complaining a lot in Pennsylvania about the Germans, then called the Pennsylvania Dutch. The fear was that they were going to Germanize rather than being Anglicized in a way. So we have this kind of a dynamic nature, a constant change in American food, which I think is very interesting and very exciting. My argument is that every 40 years, American cuisine changes, and that makes it unusual in the world. But on the other side, our attitude, our first attitude towards the new immigrant cuisines is kind of skepticism. They slowly become popular at the cheap end of it. They have an impossible time climbing up in the social ladder. Now we see that with Mexican, with Indian, with Thai. In fact, there's a big gap in the middle. Often, like, say, think about Mexican food. You get your terrific tacos and taquerias, okay? You will get some very exclusive places at the upper end of it. But there's a huge gap in the mid-market space. Our posture towards new foods is from skepticism to revaluation and upscaling of it. We have seen this.
So let's talk about the term ethnic cuisine, because you use the term ethnic in your book. It's recently come under fire. People are starting to really criticize it. What do you make of its origins?
Yeah, ethnic, in my research, it emerges in the 1950s. And it emerges as, A, for instance, that white people can have ethnicity, which is different from race, because race is seen largely as a black-white thing. And ethnicity is a way to talk about cultural difference while skirting the question of race. So that comes into play since the 1950s, and it becomes quite popular. And in fact, my research shows that over the last 5 or 10 years, the use, at least in the domain of food, is beginning to decline at the upper ends of the journalism field. So in New York Times has stopped classifying foods as ethnic. It specifies it more as, say, Indian or Indian regional, like Punjabi or Mexican or even Mexican regional, Oaxacan, Poblano, etc. So in some ways, ethnicity is a word that was kind of born to account for cultural difference just when the civil rights movement was emerging and also to avoid the polarization of race. And I think it has fulfilled its function. It is now sounds a little outdated.
Yeah. I mean, it is still totally a buzzword today, though. How long do you think it's going to take to go out of style?
I have a feeling this generation is the last generation. I think younger people use it less and less. Like any of these words, they have a social history. They come into play, they get outdated, and then by the time the next generation comes along, they're probably not going to use ethnic, like my son's generation. He's going to use more specific categories, even regional categories, rather than ethnic as a general category.
Yeah, well, I think that's a good thing. Krishnendu, it's so great to see you again. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Krishnendu Ray is chair of the Food Studies Program at New York University and author of The Ethnic Restaurateur. Von Diaz is a writer and food editor of Feet in Two Worlds. Now remember, you can listen to us whenever it's convenient. Just add us to your podcast queue, and if you don't already, follow us on Instagram and Pinterest. Every month we check in with the folks behind Cook Science and America's Test Kitchen. They are devoted to deciphering and then unfolding the techniques and science behind cooking. And they have a noble goal. They want to make all of us better cooks. Well, our managing producer, Sally Swift, talked to Molly Birnbaum, executive editor of Cook Science, about a recent discovery.
Hey, Molly, thanks for joining us again.
Thanks so much for having me.
So it's kind of deviled egg season, and I'm reminded how temperamental eggs are and how inconsistent they can be. I mean, I can do the same thing over and over and over. Sometimes the shells don't come off. Sometimes the yolk has a green ring. I mean, what is up with eggs?
That is an excellent question. Eggs are tricky. They're very, very tricky. And the fundamental challenge in cooking eggs is that an egg is not just one ingredient, but it's two ingredients in one, the white and the yolk. And they both operate very differently when you're cooking with them. The yolk itself starts to thicken at a different temperature than the white. The yolk starts to thicken at 150 degrees Fahrenheit and is fully set at 158 degrees Fahrenheit. So it's a pretty small window of time there. Whereas the white starts to thicken at 145 degrees Fahrenheit and is fully set at 180.
Well, there's no way for us to win with that situation.
There is no way to win. It's really hard to get exactly what you want, especially because you often want the white to be cooked and the yolk to be runny. Mm-hmm. So it's a delicate balance getting it to that exact right point.
So what's the right way to soft boil an egg?
So we've done a lot of experimenting, and we came up with a rather unique way of cooking soft-boiled eggs. And it's tricky because you do need the firm whites and the still runny yolk, and oftentimes because the white is on the outside, it cooks a little bit quicker. It's super tricky. So what we ended up doing is steaming the eggs. And this is because a big problem with soft-cooked eggs is keeping the water temperature and the resulting cook time correct. Every time you add or subtract an egg, or even use a different pan, that timing is thrown off. Mm-hmm. And even a 1 or 2 degree drop in temperature significantly influences the cooking time.
So steam them in a steamer like you would broccoli?
Kind of. So what we do is we bring 1/2 inch of water to a boil with a steamer in a pot and add eggs. And you can add 1 egg or you can add 6 eggs. And by steaming them, you can cook as many as you want and get them perfectly cooked each time. It takes about 6.5 minutes.
Rumor has it you've been working on a magical egg sauce as well.
Yeah, you hear correctly. So we are starting a new brand out of America's Test Kitchen called Cook Science. And one of the first things that we did for Cook Science is dive into the science of eggs, and specifically the science of the yolks. And we created a sauce that we're calling the runny egg yolk sauce, which is exactly as it sounds. It is that runny yolk from a fried egg or a poached egg, except it's isolated and it's pasteurized, and you can keep it in your fridge and put it on anything that you want to.
Okay, so tell me how we do this perfect runny egg sauce.
It's very simple. You add egg yolks and salt together, and you cook it in a water bath in a Ziploc bag. And this water bath can be done with a sous vide machine, which brings up the temperature of a water to a certain temperature and keeps it there. Or you can do it kind of hack in a cooler. You fill it halfway with boiling water. And then you add a little bit of cold water until the water in the cooler registers exactly the temperature that you want. And then you can kind of bring the temperature up or cool it down based on adding hot water or cold water.
So you have to babysit for 30 minutes while you're doing it.
You do have to babysit for 30 minutes, but it's so worth it. Mm-hmm. And my favorite thing to do with it is put it in a squeeze bottle, have it in the fridge. You could even use an old ketchup bottle that's empty and washed out. And then when you have a burger or a piece of pizza or a salad or pasta, it's really good as kind of a makeshift carbonara. You just spoon or drizzle a little bit of this sauce right in there, and it is so good.
Yeah, that is smart. Sauces are always a good idea.
Mm-hmm. Can't go wrong.
Can't go wrong. Hey, Molly, thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Eggs.
Molly Birnbaum is the executive editor of Cook Science from America's Test Kitchen. Eggs. Sally Swift is our managing producer. Now, Molly left us with that recipe for runny egg yolk sauce, a.k.a. miraculous yolk sauce. And watch the Cook Science video on that very subject. You know where you can find it all. It's at splendidtable.org. Coming up, a conversation with my favorite heirloom bean entrepreneur and why planting rosemary could be good for your memory. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. When it comes to food collecting, one all-time great for me is heirloom beans. They're like wines. Each is distinctive, and each has a great backstory. And think about the names. Good Mother Stollard, Eye of the Goat, and then the little rose-colored Santa Maria Pinquito. Well, Steve Sando got bitten by the bean bug in 2001. In little time, his Napa, California backyard was teeming with heirlooms, and he'd started Rancho Gordo, New World specialty food. New World beans fascinate him, especially the rare ones. Steve, welcome back.
I'm so happy to be here again.
So how did you get into beans?
Well, I had no ag background at all, and I was a frustrated home cook more than anything, and that's really what pushed me. And I think not having an ag background, I didn't understand the limitations of what I was doing, so I just blindly went in, and it's been an incredible success, specializing in heirloom beans in particular.
How do you define an heirloom?
Well, it's a pure seed, so you plant it and you'll get the exact same thing. A hybrid, you really don't know. And there's a place for hybrids. Like early girl tomatoes here in California are critical. So I'm not anti-hybrids. Mm-hmm. But heirlooms generally are harder to grow. They have a lower yield, but the payoff is the flavor. So coming at this as a home cook is like all I cared about was the flavor.
Well, let's talk about some of the beans that you do, because there's something like how many varieties that you're doing?
Well, we grow on the West Coast about 25 varieties, and that's most of our production. Mm-hmm. But we're also importing about 10 varieties from Mexico, and now we've just started with Poland.
Oh, interesting. Poland.
Yes. Well, we were looking for – we had a great runner bean that was really white and creamy and large, and it was – we had crop failure year after year. So I thought, who does the best ones? And for me, it was Italy. So we went looking in Italy, and it turns out most of the production for Italy is now in Poland. So the Corona bean is now we call them Royal Coronas because they're slightly different. Mm-hmm. They're a little less potatoey and even more creamy. And the Spanish or the Greeks would call them gigantes, but it's food, drink, and lodging all in one bean. It's really a highlight of my life is eating these things.
This is a bean I know, and I have to say it's like eating meat. It's a delicious bean.
Exactly.
What are some of the beans that you think, even if someone says, I don't care about beans, I don't like to eat beans, that if you could put a spoonful in their mouths, they'd just be blown away?
Well, we call them the you'll be back beans because people do think, how good could it be? I've had beans and these can't be that much different. But there's certain ones. There's one called Rio Zape and it has a hint of chocolate and a hint of coffee. And it's similar to a pinto, but you eat it. And this is the bean that got me started. I thought, oh, this is much, much better than what I was expecting. And there's one called Eye of the Goat that's super meaty but has a thin skin. Right now, we've got this lovely little alubia bean, and alubias are more Spanish. They're smaller, and they're white. The lighter ones sometimes, some of them are so creamy, they should be marked dairy. And it's really fun exploring, like, how many white beans can you have? And yet, we have about six right now, and I wouldn't even dream of giving up one of them.
Let's talk cooking. How do you, what do you think brings out the best flavor in the beans?
Well, my thinking is you should do a tiny bit of oil, a tiny bit of some aromatic or many aromatics, and water. A lot of people want to use chicken stock, and I just think it's a complete waste of chicken stock, and it doesn't allow the bean to shine. Now, if these are commodity beans from your grocery store, you might want to put a ham bone in it. But with heirloom beans, they don't really need a lot of our help. So I usually saute an onion and some garlic in olive oil. If I'm being ambitious, I'll maybe put celery or carrot in a bay leaf, and then I add water, and then that's it.
What about the idea to soak or not to soak?
I used to care deeply. I think if you're cooking beans at home, good for you, whether you do or you don't. Everyone who works for us tends to start as a soaker and ends up not soaking. And that's partly because and it's not any marketing genius. It's just we've run out of beans all the time. We don't have any beans that are over a year old. So the soaking really doesn't help that much.
So if a bean is potentially older, then you'd want to soak it.
And
a slow cooker?
That's one. I'm also an infidel, so I love slow cookers. I love pressure cookers. Uh-huh. My favorite thing is clay. So I have some clay pots and it seems to be a real trend right now. And Paula Wolfert wrote that wonderful book on clay pot cooking.
Oh, yeah.
So I tend to not go anywhere without coming home with a clay pot, but it's not always so practical. But slow cookers are great. It just, with slow cookers and pressure cookers, half the fun is the bean broth or the pot liquor. And for a bean freak like myself, that's just as important as the bean. And when you cook them that way, there's no evaporation. So I just would suggest doing an extra half hour to an hour with the lid off and allow some evaporation and life to come
in. And concentrate the broth.
Yes. Yeah.
Now, what about the question of salt or not salt when you start the beans?
Well, salting, I think, has been proven that it really doesn't matter. But I am so cheap, the thought of spending that money on the beans and then all that time and then finding out this was the one time it did matter, it just – I can't do it. So there's a point where the beans start smelling like beans instead of just the aromatics and olive oil. Mm-hmm. And you can they're not cooked, but you can tell they've given up and they're yours. And you can do what you will now. And that's at the point I normally will salt. Because you want to do it as early as possible so the beans can absorb the salt.
Right.
Otherwise, you have salty broth and bland beans. But I still – even with science telling me otherwise, I don't salt until that point.
So is that about halfway through?
Yes. Okay. And you could tell the beans aren't done at all, but you could just tell there's no turning back.
Yeah.
I think, though, the salting, the soaking, and all these things are really up to you. But my secret is for the first 15 minutes, you boil the heck out of it and just keep going. And that initial boil is foolproof as far as I'm concerned. The beans, it won't hurt them because the beans are still so hard at that point.
Right.
But a full 15 minutes of a full boil. And then I turn it down as low as it'll go and gently simmer. And if I have an easy Sunday, I keep it really low and just very gently do it. And it takes hours. Mm-hmm. If I'm in more of a hurry, I give it a somewhat. But it's that initial 15-minute boil is my foolproof secret.
What does that
today.
Do?
I don't know. It's not science. It's my fantasy life, I guess. I don't know. I think it just lets the beans know you're in charge. And there's no turning back.
I love the way you talk about the beans. Good relationship going there. Yeah.
Yeah.
Steve, thank you.
Thank you.
Steve Sando is the creator of Rancho Gordo New World Specialty Foods. You can find Steve's recipe for grilled shrimp with white bean sausage and arugula, as well as a couple of videos, one from Steve on how to cook basic beans and another from journalist Simran Sethi about how we're losing our biodiversity and what we can do about it. Find it all at splendidtable.org. In the United States, the end of the workday is synonymous with happy hour. Here's the excuse to ramp it up and let go after a long slog of a day, preferably at a lively bar with cheap drinks and even cheaper food. Ah, but the Italians have beaten us at this game. They have the secret to wrapping up the day with a lot more style. They make a pre-dinner cocktail and a light snack at once relaxing and refreshing. In Italy, this end-of-the-day ritual is called aperitivo. It's also the name of a new book by Marissa Huff, who spoke with Splendid Table contributor Shauna Seaver.
Hi, Marissa. It's so great to chat with you today.
Likewise. Thanks for having me.
Now, can you paint us a picture of this lovely Italian tradition of aperitivo?
Of course. It is a very special moment of the day. When the day comes to a close, let's say around 6, 7 p.m. through about 8 p.m. to 9 p.m. in the evenings, Italians will walk over to their local bar or cafe, meet up with friends, and sip on a fairly light cocktail, perhaps a glass of wine or a beer, and have a little bar snack to go along with that. And the point of this is really winding down, talking with friends, and enjoying the moment, something very Italian.
Now, how does this differ from the American happy hour?
Well, it's not about dollar tacos and getting drunk, that's for sure. it's strange. In places like Milan, you may end up paying more for your cocktail during the aperitivo time. The idea behind that is that it's going to be prepared in a very beautiful way, hopefully with top quality ingredients. And together with it, you're likely to be served food. That might come in the form of small plates, or if not, something that over the past, let's say, 15 years has really developed is a buffet of different foods.
Oh, that sounds great. And the book also makes mention of the fact that aperitivo is primarily a northern Italian tradition. Why is that?
Well, you know, I think that in general, northern Italians drink more. They're more accustomed to drinking alcohol. And in southern Italy, you will find that, of course, people drink wine with meals, but they don't necessarily get together to have something else ahead of their meal, whether it be lunch or dinner. Also, a number of the ingredients that go into these cocktails were produced for the first time in northern Italy. So I can reference vermouth, which is from Turin and the surrounding area, Campari, which comes from Milan, products like Aperol that are from Padova. Campari and Aperol are considered bitters. Vermouth is a more sweet ingredient, but they're all coming from northern Italy, where people traditionally drank those and enjoyed them before meals.
Now, within that region of northern Italy, you go even further to be specific about the type of aperitivo that's found. And those differences in the drinks and food are surprisingly distinct. Can you tell us about the different aperitivo scenarios in each city?
Of course. In Venice, for example, you will find a tradition that is based on bar hopping. You go from one wine bar, which they refer to as baccheri, to another, where you will stop in, probably have just a small glass of wine, which they refer to as an ombra, which is the Italian word for shadow. And you might also pick up a cicchetto, which is the equivalent of, let's say, Spanish tapas done Venetian style, baccala mantecata, which is whipped stockfish, possibly served on polenta, or even something as simple as a crostino, so a piece of toasted bread with something delicious on top. And then also in terms of the drink specifically, you'll find that they vary even from city to city within the same region. So in the Veneto region, the spritz is quite popular, which is white wine or Prosecco, soda, and normally a bitter component, which could be Campari or Aperol, most commonly. So in the town of Padua, where I'm living, Aperol's all over the place. It was created there, and also it's what the college kids are loving to drink. Padova is a university town, and come evening time, these students pour into the piazzas, especially in the summer when the weather is nice. You'll find them sipping on a spritz. Oftentimes, that might cost even less than a glass of water, so they will go through a couple of them, and they're light enough that they aren't going to get drunk. They're there just to enjoy time with their friends. And talking about the spritz, in Venice, the locals are drinking a version made with Select, which is a red bitter, similar to Campari, but less strong in alcohol. Up in Trieste, near the border with Slovenia, spritz is served bianco, so just wine and soda water, no bitter component whatsoever, and it's always garnished with a lemon. Up in the mountains, in the Dolomites, you'll find something called a jugo, where they add a elderflower syrup to it and serve that with mint. So there are regional variations on even just a single drink and not just the aperitivo as a whole. They're that specific.
Tell us about the role that food plays in the aperitivo experience.
My pleasure. We often say that Italians drink when they eat and eat when they drink. So the food is really a very important part of the aperitivo experience. And that is also something that's very regionally driven. In a place like Venice, you will find fresh fish like sardines fried beautifully and maybe served with a light sauce. I have a recipe here for salsa ruggine, which is like a rust sauce, which is slightly spicy and pairs beautifully with a fried sardine. Then other places like, let's say, Milan, you'll find that they may use their leftover risotto alla milanese, so a saffron risotto, pan-fried into like a basically a little crispy pancake, riso al salto. Absolutely beautiful, something that's so easy, you can do it at home. And then, you know, ubiquitous across northern Italy, you'll find tramezzini, so these small tea sandwiches made with what looks like Wonder Bread, but has actually only a few beautiful ingredients. It's white bread with a crust cut off, cut into triangles, and stuffed with a variety of different ingredients. It could be prosciutto, mushrooms. I include a recipe for a carbonara tramezzino that I tasted for the first time in Padua, and it's addictive. It's an Italian egg salad made with crispy guanciale and pecorino cheese, so what's not to love?
Oh, my. That all sounds absolutely delicious. Say we wanted to invite friends over and make this a reality here. What are the key components to have on hand?
You know, it really is simple. You can go out and purchase a bottle of sweet Italian vermouth, purchase a bottle of Campari, and you have the beginning of a variety of cocktails. So you mix those two ingredients and you have something called a Mito, a Milano Torino. You add soda water and it becomes an Americano. You, in place of the soda water, add gin and it's a Negroni. You add Prosecco instead of gin, it becomes the Negroni Spagliato. You can even add beer, froth beer, and make it a beer Americano. And then in terms of the food, you can make a crostini spread, toast sliced bread, preferably something like a baguette, and top it with a number of different ingredients. And should, you know, that seem already like too much work, open a bag of potato chips and pull out some olives, and you can consider that an aperitivo. It's really, the spirit is about getting together and not stressing out about inviting friends over for a special moment during the day.
Well, Marissa, you've created a beautiful book and made me very hungry and very thirsty. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Marissa Huff is author of Aperitivo, The Cocktail Culture of Italy. Contributor Shauna Seaver is the author of Real Sweet. Well, head to the website to find Marissa's Bellini recipe and her recipe for fried sardines, both favorites in Venice, by the way. Head straight to the site, splendidtable.org. Coming up, I get to talk to you. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and you're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. Well, it's time to turn to your calls. It's no secret, this is my favorite part of the show, the time when I get to talk to you. So if you're stumped about something in the kitchen or you just want to talk food, pick up your phone and give me a call. 800-537-5252. Carol is calling from Baltimore. Carol, what is on your mind?
Oh, boy. I love your show, and I'm so excited. My husband and I grow hops at Black Locust Hops, and we currently like a lot of hops, 5,000 plants under trellis.
And how many acres is that?
A little over 2 acres, and they grow something like asparagus, and in the spring, they all have to be cut back so that as they grow, they're all growing at, you know, relatively the same rate.
Yes.
Since they're edible. And we have so many. I feel like we are missing a tremendous food opportunity, and I'm just desperate for some awesome suggestions.
Well, first of all, I have to ask you, do you supply brewers, or are you beer makers?
We have our licensing to open a farm brewery, but we're not there yet. We do supply local breweries with the end product, the hop itself.
Mm-hmm. Well, okay. I'm going to dial back to my years of living in Belgium, you know, which is beer country. Yeah. And I mean, the place was filthy with hops. And sure enough, in the spring, we would see them. One of the classic ways that they were done there was with butter and a bit of onion or shallot or garlic and sautéed. Another way to do them is to think about how you might cook asparagus. For instance, toss the hops with a bit of olive oil, salt and pepper, and whatever herbs you like, and roast them.
Mm.
And you'd roast them, you know, 375 to 400 degrees, spread out on a shallow pan. And when you see that they're starting to get some color, you know, stir them every so often.
Okay.
And you want them to be tender, but taste your way through in terms of how long you want to cook them.
Okay.
They have an edge to them, mm-hmm. an edge of bitterness.
A definite bite. Some of them are citrusy, depending on the variety. Some have a little piney flavor. There's definite variety in there.
So you don't want to mess around with a lot of heavy spicing. Yeah, so I think what you need here is a fat medium, but not a lot of it, be it butter or olive oil. I prefer olive oil not only for the health reasons, but it tends to not take over as much as butter does.
Okay, so it won't overpower the...
Yeah, now butter is delicious with something that has an edge of bitterness. But just open your mind to other possibilities. I guess that's what I'm trying to say. One thing I've never tried with hops is steaming them. But I wonder what would happen if you steam them and then just toss them with a dressing, an oil and vinegar dressing.
Or
maybe even one of my favorite things I'm doing lately... You know how you try something and you say, I really like that, and then you seem to want to eat it constantly, and then it goes away for 6 months. Well, what I've got in the refrigerator now is a jar. And what I've done is I've put some minced garlic in the bottom of the jar, and I put in some vinegar. And I let that sit so the garlic would get really soft and tender, you know, not be strong. You could do that with onion. You could do it with shallot. Let that sit. And then what I do is I add a bit of mayonnaise, or... I add some sour cream or whole milk yogurt. That goes in, and then olive oil, and I shake it up, and I keep tasting, and I'll keep balancing it. Oh, the key. Mustard, grainy mustard. You do this by taste, but you want to taste a bit of the mustard. You want an underlying creaminess, and you don't want it to be too dark. And you shake that up, and that is delicious on very delicate flavors, as well as some things that are quite powerful. And I'm just wondering about those hops. Steam them lightly, just lightly cook them, and then toss them with that dressing. I think you'd get something very tasty.
Thank you so much. I am super excited. We're going to make some beautiful food.
Yeah, I'm just thinking, how many plants did you plant? 5,000?
Right now we have 5,000 under trellis, so each one sends 10 to 20 shoots up. Like, there's a tremendous food opportunity out there.
yeah, nonstop for months. You know, I wonder if they freeze. They probably do if you drop them in boiling water for a short time and then cool them. And
I then, never even thought of that. That is wonderful. Yeah.
And we've gone on and on about hops. Okay.
Love this. This is what I do all day. I love it.
Carol, thanks for a great question.
Oh, thank you so much. I appreciate it.
You're welcome.
All right. Bye.
800-537-5252. Mary's calling from Portland, Oregon. Mary?
Hello.
What do you want to talk about?
Well, I run a little coffee shop here. It's a walk-up stand. And we don't have a lot of options in the way of food because it has to be so fast.
Right.
People are catching the buses. So I think inspired by your show a couple years ago, I started offering a picnic sandwich that's salami, mozzarella, basil, roasted red pepper, and vinegar on a focaccia bun.
That sounds delicious.
Oh, it's delicious. But I'm wanting to come up with a vegetarian version, and I'm having a hard time figuring out what could stand in for the salami on those.
Well, you could do cheese. Maybe you could do a really sharp cheddar. Instead of the mozzarella, do a cheddar and do it with all kinds of vegetables. And those vegetables could be things like strips of raw sweet pepper, green beans, celery, cucumbers that you've tossed with oil and vinegar and seasonings like fresh oregano and fresh basil and a little garlic. And you can just have that sitting in a cooler. And then when you want to make the sandwich, you lift it out with a slotted spoon. It's going to throw off liquid, but you lift it out with a slotted spoon. You do your vinegar on the sandwich. You put this on the sandwich and then slices of the mozzarella or slices of a really nice cheddar. And, greens would be fabulous. Now, if you want to do a vegan version of that, you could take, hummus is obvious, but you could do something with black beans, a little bit of salsa, where you throw that in a food processor. You don't want to puree it entirely, but you just want to break up the beans a little bit so you can see splotches of the red salsa and you've got the beans. And you sprinkle that with a lot of lemon, a little bit of mild chili, and a little bit of orange juice. And that sits. And then the beans will absorb that. Do a lot of lettuce, some tomato. You spread the beans on, and then you top them with strips of sweet peppers because you want something very crunchy in there.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that could be a really delicious sandwich.
Oh, that sounds wonderful.
Yeah, and don't forget, I love your idea of the vinegar on the bread. That just gives it such a kick, and people don't think of that. And it's delicious. So I think that should help you. So where are you? You're in a bus station, or?
Yeah, so we are at the Gateway Transit Center. So three of the train lines come through, as well as a whole pile of bus lines.
Ah.
So it's a lot of commuter traffic.
Great location.
Yeah, it's all right.
Yeah, it sounds like it. You go out and make your fortune, Mary.
I hope so. Thank you.
You take care. Thanks.
All right. Thanks so much. Bye-bye.
Boy, what a great idea. By the way, don't forget, sprinkle some good-tasting vinegar on your bread. Really good. Really a nice, punchy addition to a sandwich. Rick's calling in from Fort Wayne, Indiana. Hey, Rick, what's on your mind? What do you want to talk about?
I cannot seem to keep my Alfredo sauce from breaking.
How are you making it?
I start with a double boiler. I like to use a copper bowl
over
my saucepan and heavy cream, and then slowly melt the cheese in. and then add the butter.
Okay. I'm sorry, but I may upset you a little bit.
Go ahead.
No Italian has ever done Alfredo that way.
You know, it's a recipe that somebody gave me once, and it tastes really good.
Well, that's great. And that's great. And one of the ways you're going to keep it is don't let it get too warm. And if it starts to break, add a little lemon juice.
Really?
Yeah, believe it or not, that acid helps the proteins.
That's counterintuitive.
I know it is, isn't it? It's amazing. And whisk. You know, keep it moving. And
constantly, I do.
Yeah, yeah. And just don't let it get too hot. And that should work. But do you mind if I give you the traditional Roman way of doing Alfredo?
I was just going to ask.
Okay. What it is really... I'll give you a little background. One of the best things that happens to you in Italy if you're sick is that someone will make you simple pasta tossed with butter and cheese, which is so delicious. Well, a restaurateur back in the 1920s was entertaining two very famous movie stars at that time. One of them was Douglas Fairbanks Jr. and his wife, Mary Pickford. And he wanted to make a very fancy at the table kind of pasta. And he called it Alfredo because I think that was the name of the restaurant. And what he did was you had a pan, you had the pasta cooking in a pan for a pound of pasta. You'd melt a stick of butter. OK, just melt it. You're not that's all you have to do. And when the pasta is done, you drain it and you throw it into that skillet, which is over about medium heat, and you toss and you toss and you add about a cup of heavy cream. And you keep tossing that over medium to low heat until you'll see it's all sticking to the pasta. This is a matter of a few minutes. You know, it's very quick. And then in goes the cheese and some salt and fresh ground black pepper. And that's fettuccine Alfredo. It's usually done with a slightly wider noodle called fettuccine. But you can do it with linguine. You could even do it with spaghetti. And it's fabulous. So if you want to do kind of a shortcut, you may want to give this a try someday and see what you think.
It sounds amazing and a lot less expensive. The recipe I had called for a pound of each.
Oh, my gosh.
Very, very expensive. And then using the copper pot, if I didn't get it out of there very quickly, it turned a lovely shade of blue-green.
Oh, No. No, but the thing about this, you know, the typical Italian way of doing pasta is that the sauce is a light coating, but you're tasting the pasta too. Now, if you'd want more sauce once you make this, just add a bit more butter, a bit more cream, and a bit more cheese. That's all.
I'm going to give the recipe you gave me a shot, and if that works, I'm just going to go with that.
It's really easy, and Douglas Fairbanks and Mary Pickford thought it was fabulous. Really swell.
Well, I think I'll trust them then.
Yeah. Rick, thanks for a great question.
Hey, thank you.
You take care. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Remember, if you have a question, you can reach out anytime, 800-537-5252. I think of Jekka McVicker as a goddess, an herb goddess, that is. This woman has been growing herbs for over 30 years, and her nursery, Jekka's Herb Farm, boasts the largest collection of culinary herbs in the UK. She's kind of a big deal over there. Jekka's passion and knowledge always is like a siren song to me. Well, she's joining us this summer for a series on herbs, and this month, it's rosemary. Jekka, great to have you back.
Great to be back.
I have an herb that I've always really been attracted to, and I'd love to hear your take on it, rosemary.
Now you're really talking. Rosemary is one of my absolute must-have herbs, Rosmarinus officinalis. It's just been proven to be as good as ginkgo at restoring your memory.
Really?
It has been scientifically proven. It's been even in the Telegraph newspaper here in the UK. It's so exciting because it means that we're using it with Alzheimer's and with old people to help them remember things. But someone of my age, you know, I forget where I've put my list. So if you're like me, all you have to do is put a sprig about an inch and a half, that's about 3 centimetres, right, new money, into a mug. Add boiled water, let it stand for about 5 minutes, strain and drink, and that is fantastic for clearing your head. And even the scent can trigger memories. Really, really exciting. And when you cook with it, a real plus is it helps you digest fatty food, which is why it's put with lamb. So, you know, if you're cooking lamb, you whack in the rosemary with that. It cuts the grease because it's a very greasy meat.
It's done a lot with pork, too, which is so logical.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
It's See, over here, it's not sage is used with pork over here.
Oh, that's interesting. You had said when you see officinalis as part of the Latin name of an herb, this was an herb that was used medicinally, right?
Yes.
So there's the import. This is intriguing. How else would you use it in terms of cooking?
One of the best things you can make, apart from using it with lamb, is tomato soup. When you're sweating your tomatoes down with your onions, whack in a sprig and just sweat that down as well. Oh, the flavor. A tomato and rosemary, just excellent. Roast potatoes. You know, and use King Edwards or something like that, because when you parboil them and you shake them in the pan, that roughs up the edges. Then add your oil, toss it round, and then add that to the pan. That means you use very little fat. And again, add some rosemary chopped up in that. That's brilliant. I also use rosemary as well if I'm just sort of I'm wanting to have a flavour in a food. Say if I'm making a sauce or something, I add rosemary, and it's absolutely gorgeous. It's so versatile because it's an evergreen. Here in the UK, we can use it all year round.
Yeah, and in some parts of the United States, it goes all year round. There are quite a few different kinds of rosemary, aren't there?
Do you know, I've even got one named after me now.
You do?
I have a Jekka's Blue. Yes.
Rosemary. Congratulations.
Jekka's Blue. Yeah. I'm actually involved here in England at Wisley, which is the Royal Horticultural Society, doing a trial on rosemaries, and we've got 60 different varieties. And they all taste different, flower different. You've got the piney ones. You've got the sort of full-bodied ones, which are real rosemary. You've got the big leaves. You've got the fine leaves. You've got pink flowering, blue flowering, flowering. You've got lady in white. You've got Tuscan blue. I've got one from the Vatican.
Yeah, you know, really?
It's called Vatican Blue. Yes, yeah. I mean, because rosemary, you know the story about rosemary is when Mary was on the flight from Egypt, she hid behind a bush and put her blue cloak over it, and the flowers changed from blue to white.
And
rosemarinus means it is the flower of the sea. So you can always grow it by salt. So it's fine for growing by salty air,
Now, if I recall correctly, historically, it was a favorite bride's favor that guests would receive at weddings.
Yes, in the medieval times.
Yeah.
In medieval times, yes.
So they would have a fond remembrance of her day. So even back then, there was a connection between memory and rosemary.
And Shakespeare also, of course.
Oh, yeah, that scene. Ophelia's mad scene in Hamlet.
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I'm Tanya Mosley. In 1987, my sister Anita vanished without a trace. Decades later, thanks to DNA, we found her. But that's only the beginning of the story. She Has a Name is a new audio documentary that explores the search for redemption, confronting trauma, and healing in the face of unimaginable loss. Subscribe now to Truth Be Told Presents She Has a Name, where every revelation brings us closer to the truth.